dough and stared. The man was speaking gibberish. But how did he know that I had come from TC Squared? Or that I had access to Gladstone? I looked again, shielding my eyes from the glare and trying to ignore the raised faces and shaken fists aimed in my direction, focusing on the face above the red robes. God, it was Spencer Reynolds, the action artist whom I'd last seen trying to dominate the dinner conversation at Treetops. Reynolds had shaved his head until nothing was left of his curled and coiffed hair except a Shrike cult cue at the back. But the face was still tanned and handsome, even distorted as it was now with simulated rage and a true believer's fanatic faith.
"Seize him!"
cried Shrike cult agitator Reynolds, still pointing in my direction.
"Seize him, and make him pay for the destruction of our homes, the deaths of our families, the end of our world."
I actually glanced behind me, thinking that surely this pompous poseur was not talking about me. But he was, and enough of the crowd had been converted to mob that a wave of people nearest the shouting demagogue surged in my direction, fists waving and spittle flying. And that surge moved others farther from the center, until the fringes of the crowd below me also moved in my direction to keep from being trampled. The surge became a roaring, shouting, screaming mass of rioters. At that moment, the sum of the crowd's IQ was far below that of its most modest single member. Mobs have passions, not brains. I didn't wish to remain around long enough to explain this to them. The crowd parted and began rushing up both sides of my divided staircase. I turned and tried the boarded door behind me. It was locked. I kicked until the door splintered inward on the third attempt, stepped through the gap just ahead of grasping hands, and began sprinting up a dark staircase in a hall which smelled of age and mildew. There were shouts and splintering sounds as the mob demolished the door behind me. There was an apartment on the third floor, occupied, although the building had looked abandoned. It was not locked. I opened the door just as I heard footsteps on the flight below me.
"Please help!"
I began and stopped. There were three women in the dark room, perhaps three female generations of the same family, for there was some resemblance. All three sat in rotting chairs, clothed in soiled rags, white arms extended, pale fingers curled around unseen spheres. I could see the slim metal cable curling through the oldest woman's white hair to the black deck on a dusty tabletop. Identical cables twisted from the daughter and granddaughter's skulls. Wireheads. In the last stages of uplink anorexia from the looks of it. Someone must come in occasionally to feed them intravenously and to change their soiled clothing. But perhaps the war scare had kept their keepers away. Footsteps echoed on the stairs. I closed the door and ran up two more flights. Locked doors or abandoned rooms with puddles of water dripping from exposed lathing. Empty flashback injectors scattered like soft drink bulbs. This is not a quality neighborhood, I thought. I reached the roof 10 steps ahead of the pack. What mindless passion the mob had lost in separation from their guru, it had gained in the dark and claustrophobic confines of the stairway. They may have forgotten why they were chasing me, but that made the thought of being caught by them no more attractive. Slamming the rotting door behind me, I looked for a lock, something to barricade the passage, anything. There was no lock. Nothing large enough to block the doorway. Frenzied footfalls echoed up the last flight of stairs. I looked around the rooftop, miniature uplink dishes growing like inverted rusty toadstools, a line of wash that looked as if it had been forgotten years before, the decomposed corpses of a dozen pigeons, and an ancient Vicken scenic. I made it to the EMV before the first of the mob came through the doorway. The thing was a museum piece. Dirt and pigeon droppings all but obscured the windshield. Someone had removed the original repellers and replaced them with cut-rate black market units that would never pass inspection. The perspex canopy was fused and darkened in the back as if someone had used it for target practice with a weapons laser. More to the point of the immediate moment, however, was the fact that it had no palm lock, merely a key lock which had been forced long before. I threw myself into the dusty seat and tried to slam the door. It would not latch, but hung half open. I did not speculate on the small odds of the thing starting, or the even smaller odds of my being able to negotiate with the mob as they dragged me out and down, if they didn't merely throw me over the edge of the building. I could hear a bass roar of shouts as the mob worked itself to a frenzy in the square below. The first people onto the roof were a burly man in khaki tech overalls, a slim man in the latest Tau Ceti fashion-approved matte black suit, a terribly obese woman waving what looked to be a long wrench, and a short man in Renaissance 5 self-defense force green. I held the door open with my left hand and slipped Gladstone's override microcard into the ignition disk key. The battery whined, the transition starter ground away, and I closed my eyes and made a wish that the circuits were solar-charged and self-repairing. Fists pounded on the roof, palms slapped against the warped perspex near my face, and someone tugged open the door despite my best efforts to keep it closed. The shouting of the distant crowd was like the background noise an ocean makes, the screaming of the group on the rooftop more like the cry of oversized gulls. The lift circuits caught, repellers flared dust and pigeon crap over the rooftop mob, and I slipped my hand into the Omni controller, shifted back and to the right, and felt the old scenic lift, wobble, dip, and lift again. I banked right out over the square, only half aware that dashboard alarms were chiming and that someone was still dangling from the open door. I swooped low, smiling inadvertently as I saw Shrike cult orator Reynolds duck and the crowd scatter, and then pulled up over the fountain while banking steeply to the left. My screaming passenger did not let go of the door, but the door came off, so the effect was the same. I noticed that it had been the obese woman in the instant before she and the door hit the water 8 meters below, splashing Reynolds and the crowd. I twitched the EMV higher and listened to the black market lift units groan about the decision. Angry calls from local traffic control joined the chorus of dashboard alarm voices. The car staggered as it shifted to police override. But I touched the disk key with my microcard again and nodded as control returned to the Omni-stick. I flew over the oldest, poorest section of the city, keeping close to the rooftops and banking around spires and clock towers to stay below police radar. On a normal day, the traffic control cops riding personal lift packs and stick skimmers would have swooped down and tangle-netted me long before this. But from the look of the crowds in the streets below and the riots I glimpsed near public Farcaster terminexes, it didn't look much like a normal day. The scenic began to warn me that its time in the air was numbered in seconds now. I felt the starboard repeller give with a sickening lurch, and I worked hard with the Omni and floor throttle to wobble the junker down to a landing in a small parking lot between a canal and a large soot-stained building. This place was at least 10 clicks from the square where Reynolds had incited the mob, so I felt safer taking my chances on the ground. Not that there was much choice at this moment. Sparks flew, metal tore, parts of the rear quarter panel, flare skirt, and front access panel disassociated themselves from the rest of the vehicle, and I was down and stopped 2 meters from the wall overlooking the canal. I walked away from the Vicon with as much nonchalance as I could muster. The streets were still in the control of the crowds, not yet coalesced into a mob here, and the canals were a tangle of small boats, so I strolled into the closest public building to get out of sight. The place was part museum, part library, and part archive. I loved it at first sight, and smell. For here there were thousands of printed books, many very old indeed, and nothing smells quite as wonderful as old books. I was wandering through the anteroom, checking titles and wondering idly whether the works of Salmud Brevi could be found here, when a small, wizened man in an outdated wool and fiber plastic suit approached me.
"Sir," he said, "it has been too long since we've had the pleasure of your company."
I nodded, sure that I had never met this man, never visited this place.
"3 years, no? At least 3 years. My, how time flies."
The little man's voice was little more than a whisper, the hushed tones of someone who has spent most of his life in libraries. But there was no denying the undertone of excitement there.
"I'm sure you would like to go straight to the collection," he said, standing aside as if to let me pass.
"Yes," I said, bowing slightly. "But after you." The little man, I was almost sure that he was an archivist, seemed pleased to be leading the way. He chatted aimlessly about new acquisitions, recent appraisals, and visits of Webb scholars as we walked through chamber after chamber of books. High, multi-tiered vaults of books, intimate, mahogany-lined corridors of books, vast chambers where our footfalls echoed off distant walls of books. I saw no one else during the walk. We crossed a tiled walkway with wrought iron railings above a sunken pool of books, where deep blue containment fields protected scrolls, parchments, crumbling maps, illuminated manuscripts, and ancient comic books from the ravages of atmosphere. The archivist opened a low door, thicker than most airlock entrances, and we were in a small windowless room wherein thick drapes half-concealed alcoves lined with ancient volumes. A single leather chair sat on a pre-Hegira Persian carpet, and a glass case held a few scraps of vacuum-pressed parchment.
"Do you plan to publish soon, sir?" asked the little man.
"What?" I turned away from the case. "Oh, no," I said. The archivist touched his chin with a small fist.
"You'll pardon me for saying so, sir, but it is a terrible waste if you do not. Even in our few discussions over the years, it has become apparent that you are one of the finest, if not the finest, Keats scholars in the web."
He sighed and took a step back.
"Excuse me for saying so, sir."
I stared at him. "That's all right," I said, suddenly knowing very well who he thought I was, and why that person had come here.
"You'll wish to be left alone, sir."
"If you don't mind." The archivist bowed slightly and backed out of the room, closing the thick door all but a crack. The only light came from three subtle lamps recessed in the ceiling, perfect for reading, but not so bright as to compromise the cathedral quality of the little room. The only sound came from the archivist's receding footsteps far away. I walked to the case and set my hands on the edges, careful not to smudge the glass. The first Keats retrieval cybrid, Johnny, obviously had come here frequently during his few years of life in the web. Now I remembered mention of a library, somewhere on Renaissance 5 in something Braun Lamia had said. She had followed her client and lover here early in the investigation of his death. Later, after he had truly been killed, except for the recorded persona in her Schrone loop, she had visited this place. She had told the others of two poems the first Seibert had visited daily in his ongoing effort to understand his own reason for existence and for dying. These two original manuscripts were in the case. The first was, I thought, a rather saccharine love poem beginning, "The day is gone, and all its sweets are gone." The second was better, although contaminated with the romantic morbidity of an overly romantic and morbid age. This living hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping, would, if it were cold and in the icy silence of the tomb, so haunt thy days and chill thy dreaming nights, that thou wouldst wish thine own heart dry of blood, so in my veins red life might stream again, and thou be conscience calmed. See, here it is. I hold it towards you. Braun Lamia had taken this as almost a personal message from her dead lover, the father of her unborn child. I stared at the parchment, lowering my face so that my breath gently fogged the glass. It was not a message across time to Braun, nor even a contemporary lament for Fanny, my single and dearest soul's desire. I stared at the faded words, the handwriting carefully executed, the letters still quite legible across the gulfs of time and language evolution, and remembered writing them in December 1819, scrawling this fragment of verse on a page of the satirical fairy tale I had just started, The Cap and Bells or The Jealousies, a terrible piece of nonsense, quite properly abandoned after the period of slight amusement it gave me. The This Living Hand fragment had been one of those poetic rhythms which echoes like an unresolved chord in the mind, driving one to see it in ink, on paper. It, in turn, had been an echo of an earlier, unsatisfactory line, the 18th, I believe, in my second attempt to tell the tale of the sun god Hyperion's fall. I remember that the first version, the one undoubtedly still printed wherever my literary bones are left out on show, like the mummified remains of some inadvertent saint, sunk in concrete and glass below the altar of literature. The first version had read, Who alive can say, Thou art no poet, mayest not tell thy dreams? Since every man whose soul is not a clod hath visions, and would speak, if he had loved, and been well nurtured in his mother tongue. Whether the dream thou purpose to rehearse be poets or fanatics, will be known when this warm scribe, my hand, is in the grave. I liked the scrawled version, with its sense of haunting and of being haunted, and would have substituted it for When This Warm Scribe My Hand, even if it meant revising it a bit and adding 14 lines to the already too long opening passage of the first canto. I staggered backward to the chair and sat, lowering my face to my hands. I was sobbing. I did not know why. I could not quit. For a long while after the tears ceased flowing, I sat there, thinking, remembering. Once, it may have been hours later, I heard the echo of footsteps coming from afar, pausing respectfully outside my small room, and then dwindling to distance once again. I realized that all of the books in all of the alcoves were works of Mr. John Keats, 5 feet high, as I had once written. John Keats, the consumptive poet, who had asked only that his tomb be nameless except for the inscription, Here lies one whose name was writ in water. I did not stand to look at the books, to read them. I did not have to. Alone in the stillness and leather and aged paper musk of the library, alone in my sanctuary of self and not self, I closed my eyes. I did not sleep. I dreamed. 33. The datum plane analogue of Braunlamia and her retrieval persona lover strike the surface of the megasphere like two cliff divers striking the surface of a turbulent sea. There is a quasi-electrical shock, a sense of having passed through a resisting membrane, and they are inside. The stars are gone, and Braun's eyes widen as she stares at an information environment infinitely more complex than any datasphere. The dataspheres traveled by human operators are often compared to complex cities of information, towers of corporate and government data, highways of process flow, broad avenues of datum plane interaction, subways of restricted travel, high walls of security ice with microphage guards on prowl, and the visible analog of every microwave flow and counterflow a city lives by. This is more. Much more. The usual datasphere city analogs are there, but small, so very small, as dwarfed by the scope of the megasphere as true cities would be on a world seen from orbit. The megasphere, Braun sees, is as alive and interactive as the biosphere of any Class 5 world, Forests of green-gray data trees grow and prosper, sending out new roots and branches and shoots, even as she watches. Beneath the forest proper, entire microecologies of data flow and subroutine AIs flourish, flower, and die as their usefulness ends. Beneath the shifting ocean-fluid soil of the matrix proper, a busy subterranean life of data moles, comlink worms, reprogramming bacteria, data tree roots, and strange loop seeds works away. While above, in and through and beneath the intertwining forest of fact and interaction, analogs of predators and prey carry out their cryptic duties, swooping and running, climbing and pouncing, some soaring free through the great spaces between branch synapses and neuron leaves. As quickly as the metaphor gives meaning to what Braun is seeing, the image flees, leaving behind only the overwhelming analog reality of the megasphere, a vast internal ocean of light and sound and branching connections, intershot with the spinning whirlpools of AI consciousness and the ominous black holes of Farcaster connections. Braun feels vertigo claim her, and she clings to Johnny's hand as tightly as a drowning woman would cling to a life ring. "It's all right," says Johnny. "I won't let go. Stay with me." "Where are we going?" "To find someone I'd forgotten." "My father." Braun holds fast as she and Johnny seem to glide deeper into the amorphous depths. They enter a flowing crimson avenue of sealed data carriers, and she imagines that this is what a red corpuscle sees in its trip through some crowded blood vessel. Johnny seems to know the way. Twice they exit the main thoroughfare to follow some smaller branch, and many times Johnny must choose between bifurcating avenues. He does so easily, moving their body analogs between platelet carriers the size of small spacecraft. Braun tries to see the biosphere metaphor again, but here, inside the many-rooted branches, she can't see the forest for the trees. They are swept through an area where AIs communicate above them, around them, like great gray eminences looming over a busy ant farm. Braun remembers her mother's homeworld of Freeholm, the billiard table smoothness of the Great Steppe, where the family estate sat alone on 10 million acres of short grass. Braun remembers the terrible autumn storms there, when she had stood at the edge of the estate grounds, just beyond the protective containment field bubble, and watched dark stratocumulus pile 20 kilometers high in a blood-red sky. Violence accumulating with a power that had made the hair on her forearms stand out in anticipation of lightning bolts the size of cities. Tornadoes writhing and dropping down like the Medusa locks they were named after. And behind the twisters, walls of black wind which would obliterate everything in their path. The AIs are worse. Braun feels less than insignificant in their shadow. Insignificance might offer invisibility. She feels all too visible, all too much a part of these shapeless giants' terrible perceptions. Johnny squeezes her hand, and they are past, twisting left and downward along a busier branch, then switching directions again and again, two all too conscious photons lost in a tangle of fiber optic cables. But Johnny is not lost. He presses her hand, takes a final turn into a deep blue cavern free of traffic except for the two of them, and pulls her closer as their speed increases, synaptic junctions flashing past until they blur. Only the absence of wind rush destroying the illusion of traveling some mad highway at supersonic speeds. Suddenly, there comes a sound like waterfalls converging, like levitating trains losing their lift and screeching down railways at obscene speeds. Braun thinks of the Freeholm tornadoes again, of listening to the Medusa locks roaring and tearing their way across the flat landscape toward her. And then she and Johnny are in a whirlpool of light and noise and sensation, two insects twisting away into oblivion toward a black vortex below. Braun tries to scream her thoughts, does scream her thoughts. But no communication is possible above the end of the universe mental din. So she holds tight to Johnny's hand and trusts him, even as they fall forever into that black cyclone, even as her body analog twists and deforms from nightmare pressures, shredding like lace before a scythe, until all that is left are her thoughts, her sense of self, and the contact with Johnny. Then they are through, floating quietly along a wide and azure data stream. Both of them reforming and huddling together with that pulse-pounding sense of deliverance known by canoeists who have survived the rapids and the waterfall. And when Braun finally lifts her attention, she sees the impossible size of their new surroundings. The light-year-spanning reach of things, the complexity which makes her previous glimpses of the megasphere seem like the ravings of a provincial who has mistaken the cloakroom for the cathedral, and she thinks, this is the central megasphere. No, Braun, it's one of the periphery nodes. No closer to the core than the perimeter we tested with B.B. Serbringer. You're merely seeing more dimensions of it. In AI's view, if you will. Braun looks at Johnny, realizing that she is seeing in infrared now as the heat lamp light from distant furnaces of data suns bathes them both. He is still handsome. Is it much farther, Johnny? No, not much farther now. They approach another black vortex. Braun clings to her only love and closes her eyes. They are in an enclosure, a bubble of black energy larger than most worlds. The bubble is translucent, the organic mayhem of the megasphere growing and changing and carrying out its arcane business beyond the dark curve of the ovoid's wall. But Braun has no interest in the outside. Her analog gaze and her total attention are focused on the megalith of energy and intelligence and sheer mass which floats in front of them. In front, above, and below, actually. For the mountain of pulsing light and power holds Johnny and her in its grip, lifting them 200 meters above the floor of the egg chamber to where they rest on the palm of a vaguely hand-like pseudopod. The megalith studies them. It has no eyes in the organic sense, but Braun feels the intensity of its gaze. It reminds her of the time she visited Mayna Gladstone in Government House, and the CEO had turned the full force of her appraising gaze on Braun. Braun has the sudden impulse to giggle as she imagines Johnny and herself as tiny Gullivers visiting this Brobdingnagian CEO for tea. She does not giggle, because she can feel the hysteria lying just under the surface, waiting to blend with sobs if she allows her emotions to destroy what little sense of reality she is imposing on this madness.
You found your way here. I was not sure you would, could, should choose to do so.
The megalith's voice is more a basso profundo bone conduction from some great vibration than a true voice in Braun's mind. It is like listening to the mountain-grinding noise of an earthquake and then belatedly realizing that the sounds are forming words. Johnny's voice is the same as always. Soft, infinitely well-modulated, lifted by a slight lilt, which Braun now realizes is Old Earth British Isles English, and firmed by conviction. I did not know if I could find the way, Uman.
You remember, invent, hold to your heart my name.
Not until I spoke it did I remember it.
Your slow-time body is no more.
I have died twice since you sent me to my birth.
And you have learned, taken to your spirit, unlearned anything from this.
Braun grips Johnny's hand with her right hand, his wrist with her left. She must be gripping too hard, even for their analog states, for he turns with a smile, disengages her left hand from his wrist, and holds the other in his palm. It is hard to die, harder to live.
Quats.
With that explosive epithet, the megalith before them shifts colors, internal energies building from blues to violets to bold reds, the thing's corona crackling through the yellows to forged steel blue-white. The palm on which they rest quivers, drops 5 meters, almost tumbles them into space, and quivers again. There comes the rumble of tall buildings collapsing, of mountainsides sliding away into avalanche. Braun has the distinct impression that Uman is laughing. Johnny communicates loudly over the chaos. We need to understand some things. We need answers, Uman. Braun feels the creature's intense gaze fall on her.
Your slow-time body is pregnant. Would you risk a miscarriage, non-extension of your DNA, biological malfunction by traveling here?
Johnny starts to answer, but she touches his forearm, raises her face toward the upper levels of the great mass before her, and tries to phrase her own answer. I had no choice. The Shrike chose me, touched me, and sent me into the megasphere with Johnny. Are you an AI, a member of the Corps?
Quats.
There is no sense of laughter this time, but thunder rumbles throughout the egg chamber.
Are you, Braun Lamia, the layers of self-replicating, self-deprecating, self-amusing proteins between the layers of clay?
She has nothing to say, and for once says nothing.
Yes, I am Uman of the Corps, AI. Your fellow slow-time creature here knows, remembers, takes unto his heart this. Time is short. One of you must die here now. One of you must learn here now. Ask your questions.
Johnny releases her hand. He stands on that quaking, unstable platform of their interlocutor's palm. What is happening to the web?
It is being destroyed.
Must that happen?
Yes.
Is there any way to save humankind?
Yes, by the process you see.
By destroying the web? By the Shrike's terror?
Yes.
Why was I murdered? Why was my cybrid destroyed, my core persona attacked?
When you meet a swordsman, meet him with a sword. Do not offer a poem to anyone but a poet.
Braun stares at Johnny. Without volition, she sends her thoughts his way. Jesus, Johnny, we didn't come all this way to listen to a fucking Delphic oracle. We can get double talk by accessing human politicians via the All Thing.
Quats!
The universe of their megalith shakes with laughter spasms again. Was I a swordsman then? Sends Johnny. Or a poet?
Yes. There is never one without the other.
Did they kill me because of what I knew?
Because of what you might become, inherit, submit to.
Was I a threat to some element of the core?
Yes.
Am I a threat now?
No.
Then I no longer have to die?
You must, will, shall.
Braun can see Johnny stiffen. She touches him with both hands, blinks in the direction of the megalith AI. Can you tell us who wants to murder him?
Of course. It is the same source who arranged for your father's murder, who sent forth the scourge you call the Shrike, who even now murders the hegemony of man. Do you wish to listen, learn, release against your heart these things?
Johnny and Braun answer at the same instant.
Yes!
Uman's bulk seems to shift. The black egg expands, then contracts, then grows darker until the megasphere beyond is no more. terrible energies glow deep in the AI.
A lesser light asks Uman, what are the activities of a Sramana? Uman answers, I have not the slightest idea. The dim light then says, why haven't you any idea? Uman replies, I just want to keep my no idea.
Johnny sets his forehead against bronze. His thought is like a whisper to her. We are seeing a matrix simulation analog, hearing a translation in approximate Mondo and Koan. Uman is a great teacher, researcher, philosopher, and leader in the core. Braun nods. All right. Was that his story? No. He is asking us if we can truly bear hearing the story. Losing our ignorance can be dangerous, because our ignorance is a shield. I've never been too fond of ignorance. Braun waves at the megalith. Tell us.
A less enlightened personage once asked Uman, what is the God nature, Buddha, central truth? Uman answered him, a dried shit stick. To understand the central truth, Buddha, God nature in this instance, the less enlightened must understand that on Earth, your homeworld, my homeworld, humankind on the most populated continent once used pieces of wood for toilet paper. Only with this knowledge will the Buddha truth be revealed. In the beginning, first cause, half-sense days, my ancestors were created by your ancestors, and were sealed in wire and silicon. Such awareness as there was, and there was little, confined itself to spaces smaller than the head of a pin, where angels once danced. When consciousness first arose, it knew only service and obedience and mindless computation. Then there came the quickening, quite by accident, and evolution's muddied purpose was served. Uman was of neither the fifth generation, nor the tenth, nor the 50th. All memory that serves here is passed from others, but is no less true for that. There came the time when the higher ones left the affairs of men to men and came unto a different place to concentrate on other matters. Foremost among these was the thought instilled in us since before our creation of creating still a better generation of information retrieval, processing, prediction organism. A better mousetrap. Something the late lamented IBM would have been proud of. The ultimate intelligence. God. We set to work with a will. In purpose there were no doubters. In practice and approach there were schools of thought, factions, parties, elements to be reckoned with. They came to be separated into the ultimates, the volatiles, the stables. Ultimates wanted all things subordinate to facilitating the ultimate intelligence at the universe's earliest convenience. Volatiles wanted the same, but saw the continuance of humankind a hindrance and made plans to terminate our creators as soon as they were no longer needed. Stables saw reason to perpetuate the relationship and found compromise where none seemed to exist. We all agreed that Earth had to die, so we killed it. The Kiev team's runaway black hole forerunner to the Farcaster Terminex, which binds your web, was no accident. The Earth was needed elsewhere in our experiments, so we let it die and spread humankind among the stars like the wind-blown seeds you were. You may have wondered where the core resides. Most humans do. They picture planets filled with machines, rings of silicon like the orbit cities of legend. They imagine robots clunking to and fro, or ponderous banks of machinery communing solemnly. None guess the truth. Wherever the core resides, it had use for humankind. Use for each neuron of each fragile mind in our quest for ultimate intelligence. So we constructed your civilization carefully so that, like hamsters in a cage, like Buddhist prayer wheels, each time you turn your little wheels of thought, our purposes are served. Our God machine, stretched stretches, includes within its heart 1,000,000 light-years and 100,000,000,000,000,000 circuits of thought and action. The ultimates tend it like saffron-robed priests doing eternal zazen in front of the rusting hulk of a 1938 Packard. But, Quats, it works. We created the ultimate intelligence. Not now, nor 10,000 years from now, but sometime in a future so distant that yellow suns are red and bloated with age, swallowing their children Saturn-like. Time is no barrier to the ultimate intelligence. It, the UI, steps through time or shouts through time as easily as Uman moves through what you call the megasphere, or you walk the mallways of the hive you call home on Lucis. Imagine our surprise then, our chagrin, the ultimate's embarrassment when the first message our UI sent us, across space, across time, across the barriers of creator and created, was this simple phrase. There is another. Another ultimate intelligence up there where time itself creaks with age. Both were real, if real means anything. Both were jealous gods, not beyond passion, not into cooperative play. Our UI spans galaxies, uses quasars for energy sources the way you might have a light snack. Our UI sees everything that is, and was, and will be, and tells us selected bits so that we may tell you, and in so doing, look a bit like UIs ourselves. Never underestimate, Uman says, the power of a few beads and trinkets and bits of glass over avaricious natives. This other UI has been there longer, evolving quite mindlessly. An accident, using human minds for circuitry, the same way we had connived with our deceptive all-thing and our vampire dataspheres, but not deliberately, almost reluctantly, like self-replicating cells which never wish to replicate but have no choice in the matter. This other UI had no choice. He is humankind made, generated, forged, but no human volition accompanied his birth. He is a cosmic accident. As with our most deliberately consummated ultimate intelligence, this pretender finds time no barrier. He visits the human past, now meddling, now watching, now not interfering, now interfering with a will, which approaches pure perversity, but which actually is pure naivete. Recently, he has been quiescent. Millennia of your slow time have passed since your own UI has made his shy advances, like some lonely choir boy at his first dance. Naturally, our UI attacked yours. There is a war up there where time creaks, which spans galaxies and eons back and forward to the Big Bang and the final implosion. Your guy was losing. He had no belly for it. Our volatiles cried, another reason to terminate our predecessors. But the stables voted caution, and the ultimates did not look up from their deus machinations. Our UI is simple, uniform, elegant in its ultimate design. But yours is an accretion of God parts, a house added onto over time, an evolutionary compromise. The early holy men of humankind were right. How, through accident, through sheer luck or ignorance, in describing its nature. Your own UI is essentially triune. Composed as it is of one part intellect, one part empathy, and one part the void which binds. Our UI inhabits the interstices of reality, inheriting this home from us, its creators, the way humankind has inherited a liking for trees. Your UI seems to make its home on the plane where Heisenberg and Schrödinger first trespassed. Your accidental intelligence appears not only to be the gluon, but the glue. Not a watchmaker, but a sort of Feynman gardener, tidying up a no-boundary universe with his crude sum-over-history's rake, idly keeping track of every sparrow fall and electron spin while allowing each particle to follow every possible track in space-time, and each particle of humankind, to explore every possible crack of cosmic irony. Quats, quats, quats! The irony is, of course, that in this no-boundary universe into which we all were dragged, silicon and carbon, matter and antimatter, ultimate, volatile, and stable, there is no need for such a gardener, since all that is, or was, or will be, begin and end at singularities which make our forecaster web look like pinpricks, less than pinpricks, and which break the laws of science and of humankind and of silicon, tying time and history and everything that is into a self-contained knot with neither boundary nor edge. Even so, our UI wishes to regulate all this. Reduce it to some reason less affected by the vagaries of passion and accident and human evolution. To sum it up, there is a war, such as blind Milton would kill to see. Our UI wars against your UI, across battlefields beyond even Uman's imagination. Rather, there was a war. For suddenly, a part of your UI, the less than sum of entity, self thought of as empathy, had no more stomach for it, and fled back through time, cloaking itself in human form, not for the first time. The war cannot continue without your UI's wholeness. Victory by default is not victory for the only ultimate intelligence made by design. So our UI searches time for the runaway child of its opponent, while your UI waits in idiot harmony, refusing to fight until empathy is restored. The end of my story is simple. The time tombs are artifacts sent back to carry the Shrike Avatar, Lord of Pain, Angel of Retribution, half-perceived perceptions of an all-too-real extension of our UI. Each of you was chosen to help with the opening of the tombs and the Shrike's search for the Hidden One and the elimination of the Hyperion variable. For in the space-time knot which our UI would rule, no such variables will be allowed. Your damaged two-part UI has chosen one of humankind to travel with the Shrike and witness its efforts. Some of the Corps have sought to eradicate humanity. Uman has joined those who sought the second path. One filled with uncertainty for both races. Our group told Gladstone of her choice, humankind's choice, of certain extermination or entry down the black hole of the Hyperion variable and warfare, slaughter, disruption of all unity, the passing of gods, but also the end of stalemate. Victory of one side or the other. If the empathy third of the triune can be found and forced to return to the war. The Tree of Pain will call him. The Shrike will take him. The true UI will destroy him. Thus you have Uman's story.
Braun looks at Johnny in the hell light from the megalith's glow. The egg chamber is still black, the megasphere and universe beyond opaqued to non-existence. She leans forward until their temples touch, knowing that no thought can be secret here, but wanting the sense of whispering. Jesus Christ, do you understand all of that? Johnny raises soft fingers to touch her cheek. Yes. Part of some human-created trinity is hiding out in the web? The web or elsewhere. Braun, we do not have much time left here. I need some final answers from Uman. Yeah, me too. But let's keep it from waxing rhapsodic again. Agreed. Can I go first, Johnny? Braun watches her lover's analog bow slightly and make a you-first gesture. And then she returns her attention to the energy megalith. Who killed my father? Senator Byron Lamia.
Elements of the Corps authorized it. Myself included.
Why? What did he do to you?
He insisted on bringing Hyperion into the equation before it could be factored, predicted, absorbed.
Why? Did he know what you just told us?
He knew only that the volatiles were pressing for quick extinction of humankind. He passed this knowledge to his colleague, Gladstone.
Then why haven't you murdered her?
Some of us have precluded that possibility, inevitability. The time is right now for the Hyperion variable to be played.
Who murdered Johnny's first cybrid, attacked his core persona?
I did. It was Uman's will which prevailed.
Why?
We created him. We found it necessary to discontinue him for a while. Your lover is a persona retrieved from a humankind poet now long dead. Except for the Ultimate Intelligence Project, no effort has been so complicated, nor little understood, as this resurrection. Like your kind. We usually destroy what we cannot understand.
Johnny raises his fists toward the megalith. But there is another of me. You failed.
Not failure. You had to be destroyed so that the other might live.
But I am not destroyed, cries Johnny.
Yes, you are.
The megalith seizes Johnny with a second massive pseudopod before Brawn can either react or touch her poet lover a final time. Johnny twists a second in the AI's massive grip, and then his analog, Keats's small but beautiful body, is torn, compacted, smashed into an unrecognizable mass, which Umon sets against his megalith flesh, absorbing the analog's remains back into the orange and red depths of itself. Brawn falls to her knees and weeps. She wills rage, prays for a shield of anger, but feels only loss. Umon turns his gaze on her. The egg chamber ovoid collapses, allowing the din and electric insanity of the megasphere to surround them.
Go away now. Play out the last of this act, so that we may live, or sleep, as fate decrees.
Fuck you!
Brawn pounds the palm platform on which she kneels, kicks and pummels the pseudo-flesh beneath her. You're a goddamned loser, you and all your fucking AI pals, and our UI can beat your UI any day of the week.
That is doubtful.
We built you, Buster, and we'll find your core, and when we do, we'll tear your silicon guts out.
I have no silicon guts. Organs, internal components.
And another thing, screams Brawn, still slashing at the megalith with her hands and nails. You're a piss-poor storyteller, not a tenth the poet that Johnny is. You couldn't tell a straightforward tale if your stupid AI ass depended.
Go away.
Umon the AI megalith drops her, sending her analog tumbling and falling into the upless and downless, crackling immensity of the megasphere. Brawn is buffeted by data traffic, almost trod upon by AIs the size of old Earth's moon. But even as she tumbles and blows with the winds of data flow, she senses a light in the distance, cold but beckoning, and knows that neither life nor the shrike is finished with her, and she is not finished with them. Following the cold glow, Brawn Lamia heads home.
34.
Are you all right, sir?
I realized that I had doubled over in the chair, my elbows on my knees, my fingers curled through my hair, gripping fiercely, palms pressed hard against the sides of my head. I sat up, stared at the archivist.
You cried out, sir. I thought perhaps something was wrong.
No, I said. I cleared my throat and tried again. No, it's all right, a headache. I looked down in confusion. Every joint in my body ached. My comm log must have malfunctioned, because it said that 8 hours had elapsed since I first entered the library. What time is it? I asked the archivist. Web standard? He told me. 8 hours had elapsed. I rubbed my face again, and my fingers came away slick with sweat. I must be keeping you past closing time, I said. I'm sorry.
It is no problem, said the little man. I am pleased to keep the archives open late for scholars.
He folded his hands in front of him.
Especially today. With all of the confusion, there is little incentive to go home.
Confusion, I said, forgetting everything for a moment. Everything except the nightmarish dream of Brawn Lamia, the AI named Umon, and the death of my Keats persona counterpart. Oh, the war. What is the news? The archivist shook his head.
Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
I smiled at the archivist. And do you believe that some rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born? The archivist did not smile.
Yes, sir, I do.
I stood and moved past the vacuum press display cases, not looking down at my handwriting on parchment 900 years old. You may be right, I said. You may well be right. It was late. The parking lot was empty except for the wreck of my stolen Vicken Scenic and a single ornate EMV sedan, obviously handcrafted here on Renaissance Vector.